Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Wednesday, April the 24th. And welcome to our commentary. You know, it was 44 years ago this month, this week, that we had something called the Mariel boat lift. For me personally, it was quite an experience because even though, you know, obviously I was in touch with Cuba because having come here as a 12-year-old, but I had been detached from Cuba a little bit throughout the 1970s, not on purpose, but simply because I had so many other things going on with my life, school and everything else, that I had kind of gotten, you know, far away from Cuba. I wasn't talking about Cuba other than with my parents from time to time. But Mariel sort of hit me between the eyes and reminded me of where I came from, you know, what that island and people escaping that island hit me between the eyes, and all of a sudden I realized why we came and why my parents left and the whole story of Mariel. So with us today is my good friend Marcos Nelson Suarez, who lives here in the Dallas area. And Marcos left Cuba with Mariel 44 years ago. So let me introduce Marcos. How are you, Marcos?
I'm still alive.
Okay. Well, I think we can say that about all of us. Yes, we're still alive. But, you know, it was 44 years has gone by very fast. I sometimes remember my mother used to say in her good Cuban Spanish, después de 21, el tiempo vuela. After you turn 21, the time flies. Yes. And I have to think my late mother was right, because the time has flown for you personally. Having come here, can you believe that it was 44 years ago this week that you were leaving? Does that have you thought about that, Marcos?
Of course, I thought about that, and thanks God that I am here.
Yes. Yeah. No, you're right, and we're so grateful that we met you here. But I do want to say that, you know, you came here with about 100,000 people, Cubans, who left the island. You came to the United States. You became a successful businessman. You had a newspaper here in the Dallas area called El Hispano News, very successful newspaper. So you made a tremendous contribution to our country, to the United States, to our city. Just out of curiosity, why did you get into the newspaper business? What attracted you about having your own newspaper, Marcos?
Well, what happened is that when I landed in the U.S., of course, the first place that I went was Miami, and, you know, where most of the Cubans live. And I was desperate to tell my story and the story of what was happening in Cuba. So I get involved with all the Cuban newspapers in the Miami area. I was writing for several newspapers, and in fact, one of them hired me like a steady position. And I spent almost a year until I moved to San Francisco in 1982. But at that time, I was writing mostly for the Cuban community. So my interest in being involved with newspapers and sometimes in TV was to make the people aware of the situation in Cuba. So it was a political decision. And of course, I made it living, if we can call it that, at that time.
Sure. Writing for newspaper. No, I'm sure you did. But when you were in Cuba, did you have any interest in journalism? Or was that something that happened here?
Honestly, I remember that I published, like in the 70s, a little story of the Havana Cathedral and their style on a Cuban, or the government newspaper called Juventud Rebelde. In fact, I start when I was recruited by an organization in Cuba. At that time, it was called the Columna Juvenil Centenario. I don't even know how to translate that. But it was just a way for the government to put together all these youngsters who were not set off for the military. And actually, the military didn't want me because my past there, I was arrested for the first time when I was 16 years old. And when I get into the military, they didn't have that information. They have all these plans for me, including send me to the film section of the armed forces. And for that, they need to check very closely my records. Once they find out that I was arrested by the state security police, they don't want me even in the military. Right.
Now, you might have been lucky because at that time, Cuban troops were going to Angola and to Africa, right?
Let me tell you something.
Yeah, please.
But that time, I was already out of the military. I never fulfilled the 3 years that you are supposed to be in the conscription for the military. I just lasted for a year and a half, and I offered myself as a voluntary to go to Angola because I said, idiot of me, because I didn't know better. If I can go to Angola, maybe I can escape to another country there and being able to get out of Cuba. I guess they imagined something like that, and of course they didn't accept my...
Right. They didn't want you to go from Angola. Where would you go from Angola? I guess you could go, I don't know what countries around Angola, Uganda with the other one, whatever it is, but yes. South Africa, okay, well, that would have been a better place to go to. But tell me, take yourself mentally for a few minutes back to 79, 80. That was a time of happenings in Cuba. What I remember up here of that time was that many Cubans were going to the island. Many Cubans were going to the island and they were going back and taking things to their families. There was a lot of travel from the exile, el exilio, to the island. So I remember at that time, talking to Cubans, friends of my parents, of my generation, and they would say, oh, we're going to Cuba and we're going to take whatever to our relatives. So that's what I remember of that time, 1979, early 1980. What I remember was Cubans going to the island and bringing things. So what do you remember of that time?
Well, actually, you know, by the end of the 70s, it was etched in our brain that the system was not susceptible to change, that nothing will change. The visit of the exiles going back to Cuba somehow create, I don't want to say delusion, but the possibility maybe that we can have a better life if we can get out of Cuba, despite all the difficulties to accomplish that. To me, seeing all these people, all these Cubans going back, showing everything that they accomplished, give me somehow some hope and the determination that I need to get out of here.
Right. And so, go ahead.
I'm sorry, before I forget this
point. Go ahead.
The visit of the Cuban exile into their own country really motivate people like me that at a certain point thought it's not changed, nothing is going to happen, we are condemned to live here, to say there is a possibility. Right. And we need to find that possibility.
Right.
Precisely the visit of the Cuban exile.
Right. And that is, you know, that's what I remember of that time, because I remember talking, not my family, nobody in my family went, but I remember friends who would go back to Cuba and they would, you know, as they say, una maleta llena, right? They would have a big, big bag of things that they would take back, you know?
Yeah.
And they were saying, taking this stuff back because they wanted to help the families. It was, you know, it was in family interest. But I think all of a sudden, young people like you at the time we're watching this and you were saying, wait a minute, you know, it's not as bad up there as they're telling us it is.
Exactly.
So maybe it was time to go. So when, in your particular case, when did you decide, you personally, when did you decide to get on the boat? When did you decide to actually say, hey, I'm leaving and I'm leaving tomorrow? When did you decide that?
Look, since I was arrested in 1966, I knew that I didn't have a future in Cuba. Of course, Cuba is an island. Getting out of there was not an easy task. I talked to some friends, I talked to some people to build a raft or something. And then Cubans start getting there and people like me who were desperate saw in the return of some of the exiles that we need to get out of here. We need to find a way and kind of revive that decide to get out of there, particularly seeing all these people who have been were able to accomplish that. So and, to me, since I was arrested, I want to get out of the country.
Yeah, because you had grown. I mean, you and I are about the same age, and I left when I was 12. So you stayed. So you obviously were indoctrinated or were exposed to indoctrination more than I was. But you were disillusioned, if I hear you correctly. You were disillusioned by the late 70s. So were many people, many young people like you were disillusioned because the revolution, as they call it, had not provided you not just material wealth, but you sense maybe a lack of freedom, a lack of opportunity.
Oh, totally.
I also remember during that time, I don't know, it was exactly the same. I think it was the same year that people like, was this lady, Aide Santa Maria, who committed suicide, I think?
Yes.
Because she became so disillusioned, I think, with the regime. That she became disillusioned. Many people were disillusioned. And you decided that it was time to go. So walk me through. Just tell me how that happened. I mean, you know, as much as you can remember, how did that happen? I mean, what day did you leave? How did you get on the boat? And just walk us through that experience.
Okay. At the end of the 70s, Cuba was like a pressure pot. I mean, there was an air of discontent and frustration. And this is what happened. This group of Cubans from Miami that I believe, and I don't have any proof of this, that was an operation of the Cuban government. Went back to Cuba in a boat, went to Mariel, the port of Mariel, and asked the government to allow them to take their relatives with them to the United States. And they allowed that. And then Fidel Castro, the dictator, went out a few days later and say, whoever wanna go can go. The government opened offices in every municipality where you can apply to leave the country. And I went there and applied. At that moment, already the boat, everything that float in Miami went to Cuba. From little boats to raft, everything. By the thousands, I mean, we reach a point where almost literally you can walk from boat to boat from Cuba back.
Right. I remember that because I remember hearing stories of Cubans in the U.S., in Miami, literally grabbing a boat and going to Cuba, picking up their family. So I remember all of that just from watching the news. And I think our family had a friend of a friend, who did exactly that. The guy rented a boat, one of these big fishing boats, and went to Cuba and picked up all his family and brought him to the United States. I mean, that's I remember that from this side. Exactly. I remember hearing that.
Exactly. So the Cuban government opened offices in different municipalities where you can apply. At the same time when all the boats were coming to Cuba, they were empty the prisons and putting everybody there in boats. Because what they were trying to do was to portray us as criminals, scoria, bad people, people who will not contribute to society. And I took advantage of that situation, and I think that 1 week or 2 weeks after the whole Mariette Ball Leaf starts, I was advised that I need to go to the police station, and from there, being taken to the Mariette Port.
Right. Now, there was also something that I remember. Please help me with this.
Sure.
I remember watching a speech on television where Fidel Castro said, "No los queremos." If they want to leave, you know, leave.
We don't.
And then the next day, there's 10,000 people at the Peruvian embassy. I remember watching that in the news. That the next day, there's 10,000 Cubans in the Peruvian embassy seeking asylum. Right? Do you remember that?
It took 36 hours. In fact, I was in Havana. I am from a little town south of Havana. I was in Havana with a friend, and I remember opening the Juventud Rebelde newspaper that is used to be an afternoon edition, and reading a small paragraph in the front page about what was happening in the embassy. And me and my friend, 36 hours after that, we decided to go to the Peruvian embassy. And we went to the Miramar municipality there in Havana. And already they have about 30 blocks around the Peruvian embassy. They have a blockade where you were not a resident, you could not pass. I don't know if you know the circumstances, but everything starts when in December, 12 Cubans in a school bus penetrate by force in the Peruvian embassy.
Yeah, I remember hearing that, but not in December. I remember hearing that later, after I was hearing the story of Mariel. I remember that story.
That was the point, because at that point, the guards, remember, at least in my time, every country that has an embassy in Cuba, the embassy was protected with machine guns. You could not even walk the side.
Well, did we lose you there for a second? Yeah, we just lost Marcos. Marcos, can you hear me? Okay, I cannot hear you, Marcos. Try it. Let me see. Hold on. I cannot hear you. I cannot hear you right now. I cannot hear you. Turn on your microphone, because I cannot hear you. Try your microphone again, please. But anyway, we're recalling the story of Mariel while we get the connection back. Calling the story of Mariel, and as I mentioned at the beginning, this was for me personally quite a moment, because it really reconnected me with Cuba in a way. Now, I've heard other people, for example, say the same thing about Elian Gonzalez, that was the moment that they turned around. But for me, it was Mariel. That was the moment that it really, all of a sudden, I got connected with Cuba, because I had been a bit disconnected, to say the least, for the 70s, not on purpose, but just because there were other things going on in the world. Marcos, do we have you back on? I cannot hear you, though. That's the problem. I cannot hear you. I cannot hear you for whatever reason, but I cannot hear you. I'm sorry. I cannot hear you. Try your settings again. And I tell you what, why don't we disconnect? Let's disconnect and connect again, please. So let's disconnect and just connect. Try connecting one more time there, our friend. So anyway, let me tell you a little bit about Marcos Nelson while we're resetting everything. He came to the Dallas area, and I met him, I guess, in the late 1980s. I met him around here. And he put together a newspaper called El Hispano News. And this was a very popular newspaper in the area. And that's how we met. And that's how he made a name for himself here in the area. Marcos, can you hear me? But I cannot hear you. I don't know what's going on. I cannot hear you. So I don't know what's going on. All of a sudden, I cannot hear you. Marcos, why don't we do this? Let's disconnect and try again. Okay, maybe it's just a... So let's just disconnect and try again. So anyway, so we're talking to Marcos now, so we're going to try to reconnect again. We just had a technical problem. But so Marcos comes to the United States, just as he was telling us how he left Cuba, comes to the United States, eventually ends up in the Dallas, Texas area where I meet him sometime in the late 1980s, sometime in that time frame. And he at the time had started the newspaper called El Hispano News. And that newspaper became quite a significant newspaper in the Hispanic community. Obviously, in Texas, the Hispanic community is different than it would be, let's say, in Miami or New York. This is a much more Mexican community. So obviously, the focus of his coverage had to be broader, more than just Cuba. But he began writing editorials, and he became a very well-known figure in the journalism. Let's try this time. Marcos, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear
me? Okay, great. Super, perfect. Super. We're connected. So anyway, while we were reconnecting, Marcos, I was just to set you up, I was relating the story of how we met, that we met in the late 80s. I remember there was some social event about Cuba that we met. And then, you were doing the newspaper El Hispano, and I was explaining to people that in our part of the country, it's a little different, of course, than it would be in Miami or New York. There's a heavy Mexican influence here. So obviously your news coverage wouldn't be just about Cuba, although you did write a great deal about Cuba. So when you were telling us the story, you were about ready to leave, right? So why don't you pick it up there?
Okay, well, like I said before, Cuba at the end of the 70s was like a pressure cooker, and this boat that I always suspect that this was an operation organized by the Cuban government, but I don't have any base to say that. But this boat from Miami arrived. Went to the Mariel boat lift, to the Mariel port, and told the officers over there that they came to pick up their family. Castro, at that point, went into one of those long and boring speeches, saying, whoever want to go, can go. So, these 12 people penetrate in a school bus the embassy of Peru in Havana. The guards, the Cuban guards that protect the embassy, start shooting. One of the guards shoot the other, and then the Cuban government asks the Peruvian government to send the 12 people that went into the bus back to the Cuban government. The Peruvian government says they didn't have any weapon, they have the right to asylum, and we are not going to return them. So the Cuban government, I believe it was on April the 4th, published a note in the Juventud Rebelde newspaper saying, from this point on, the protection of the Peruvian embassy will be left to the hands of the Peruvian authorities. In 36 hours, after that announce was made, 10,800 people penetrate the Peruvian embassy. And you can imagine, Peru is not the United States. It's not a big country. So the people were in the roof, in the trees. And that was the beginning of the whole crisis, because then Castro went out We don't need them. We don't want them. And whoever want to go can go.
Right. And that's the speech that I remember watching.
Yes.
Because at that time, the news was covering. Remember, this is 1980, so we barely had CNN at that
Correct.
Time.
Correct.
So this was a different media world. You know, you didn't have all the social media and all of that you have now.
Exactly.
So we used to get the news reports, you know, from the main networks. One of the shortwave stations was broadcasting a lot. I think it was the Voice of America that were broadcasting a lot about what was happening in Cuba.
Yes.
But, you know, the information is not like now. You know, sometimes, you know, you talk to young people now, like my sons or your son or whatever, and they tend to think that we always had social media. And you know what I mean? And they don't realize that there was a time when we had one 5:30 news, and that's it. And, you know, there was a totally different world. But the news started getting up here. We started getting the news. And everybody up here was informed of what was going on. Then, you know, people started coming, and people like you eventually came to the United States. And as I mentioned in my introduction, you successfully started a newspaper and started a new life. And you were able to, you know, to enjoy your time in the United States. Now, because we're going fast with the time, I want to bring us to now, 2024. You mentioned to me this off the air that in the last year, 200,000 people had left Cuba. I didn't know that it was that many. 200,000 people. That's an incredible number.
I mean, remember that in the 90s, we have the Balseros.
Right, right.
So,
and even back in my time, you know, when you had the Freedom Flights, you didn't have 200,000 people leaving in one year. So this is a huge number by historical sense. So tell me what's going on in Cuba. I know it's a complicated case, but just as far as you can tell, what's going on in Cuba right now, and does it resemble potentially Mariel, or not Mariel, but the time before Mariel? Tell me what you see.
So, I mean, a few things that need to be clarified by the people who don't know that much about a socialist system. First, in history, never a socialist system has been toppled from down to up. Only when the top, when the government decide that it's time to change, and this is very important, only when the government, like in Poland or Czechoslovakia, when the government decide that it's time to change, they change. But never from down to up. Never, because the population requested. You have repression, you have people thrown in jail, all this stuff. In fact, I'm mind-boggling about what happened in Eastern Europe, that right now we don't have any socialist country. So the only remedy that people in these countries have is trying to get out of there. And in this case, we're talking about Cuba. So even since Mariel, when 126,000 escaped the island, including me, because the government allowed us to do that, after labor laws in speeches and everything like escoria and worms and all that bad stuff. So the only remedy that the people has in the case of Cuba is to get out of there. Like I told you, out of the program just last year, because it never stopped. But in this massive wave, last year, at least 200,000 Cubans have been able to get out of the country.
Right. And just recently, I was talking to a young couple here who left Cuba, here in the Dallas area, who left Cuba, and I was talking to them. And yes, I mean, they were, you know, a young couple living in Havana, and they were talking about all the problems. And it seems to me that the Cuban government has lost the people. The only thing they have is, like you were talking before, they've got control. And as long as, you know, I don't know if there's going to be a change when Raul Castro passes away. He's getting up there in age. I don't think Díaz-Canel is the answer. He may be a transition figure. I don't know. But,
you have a situation here.
Yes.
All the people in the high-ranking positions know, and even in the lower one, people who enjoy certain privilege because they are in the military, because they are in the Communist Party, and they have privilege. They have access to food that my family didn't have, okay? So all these people are afraid that if there is a change, a radical change, they will have to answer to the people. And some of that could end bloody. So they're going to hang to power as long as they can. And like I say before, never a communist system has been toppled from down to up.
Right.
When the people in the top say, now is the time.
Right. No, you're exactly right. And first of all, I want to thank you for joining us today and reconnecting us with that story of Mariel 44 years ago and giving us your personal story as well as your input. It's good to see you. And really, thank you for giving us your time. I appreciate it very much. And I guess you and I have to get together for lunch one of these days. And
you pay.
And I pay. Since I since I invite you to the show, I guess I have to pay.
Oh, you.
And so I'll pay. I'll invite the next time. And maybe we can get together and have an opportunity to talk a little bit more. But my very best to you and to your wife and to your family. And thank you so much, really, for joining us today. We'll do it some other time. We'll have another show some other time.
Thank you, Silvio.
All right. My good friend, Marcos Nelson Suarez, as I mentioned in the introduction, I've known him for about almost 35 years now. And for a long time, the editor and publisher of El Hispano News here in the area, a very successful Spanish-speaking paper that was distributed and circulated here in the area. The situation of Mariel 44 years ago, for me personally, was quite a changing situation because it sort of reconnected me with Cuba. And I've been following Cuba very much ever since. And I do agree with Marcos, it's tough to see change in Cuba. But on the other hand, who knows? Who knows who's going to move the pieces at the top, like Marcos was saying, and we may have a surprise. All I can tell you is talking to this couple that I met here recently, young couple coming from Cuba, the situation is very unhappy. People are super unhappy. And Marcos is right. The only option for many of them is just to get out of the country because there's no hope in the country. There's no hope for Cubans in Cuba, which is really very sad to think about that for a second, that the only option you have is to get out of your country. But then, you know, I should know because my parents reached a similar conclusion many years ago, back in 1964. Thank you for listening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye, everybody.